I am honored to be introducing Rob this morning and to be on a call with all of you guys. And I was trying to figure out what I wanted to share about Rob, and I think I want to start by giving you a sense of the unique circumstances in which his connection to service space really blossomed. And it's funny because 3 months ago, none of us had heard of him. And then 2 months ago, serendipity very briefly crossed his path with ours. And then 1 month ago, a global group of 40 leaders from the service-based ecosystem were hosted for 3 days in Phoenix at the Royal Arcadia Hacienda, which is Rob's breathtaking, gracious retreat property. And just last evening, I learned of this Japanese phrase that really brought Rob to mind. And the phrase is Ichigo Ichi, and it literally means one chance, one meeting. Or in other words, every meeting is precious. And Rob is really someone who lives the wisdom of that very deeply. And I know this because of what happened during my first meeting with him, which was actually much like this call in that it was not an in-person meeting, but over the phone. I'd been surfing the web looking for affordable rental properties big enough to host our rather big retreat. And I don't think of myself as an impulsive person, but when I landed on the listing for Rob's beautiful property, without pausing for thought or even to read it fully, my hand immediately picked up the phone and dialed his number. And I was utterly unprepared for the deep listening presence I found on the other end of the line. Very quickly, it was clear that Rob really wasn't your typical businessman. When he found out that we were doing a nonprofit retreat, his voice lit up. When he heard what kind of a nonprofit it was, I remember he breathed out one word, wow. When he read up on service space, he wrote in that it had brought him to tears. And when he heard our modest budget was less than a third of his normal rate, he said, I want to make this work for you. And then he stepped it up and blew us away by sending us a bill for $0. Karma kitchen style, as he sweetly put it. In Phoenix, he became an integral part of our retreat, and it was really almost impossible to believe that he hadn't been a part of service space for ages. He fit in that seamlessly. In our first conversation, Rob talked about being a meditator, and I'll never forget the way he quietly said, at this stage in my life, I am aspiring to live a life of service. And as we each interacted with him, we got humbling glimpses of his unusual journey, glimpses of the suffering that he's endured and transformed, glimpses of the daunting odds that his life has defied, and glimpses of the wisdom and insight in his generosity. He is so many things at once. A homeless street kid turned successful entrepreneur. He's a pilgrim, a parent, an artist, a recognizer of beauty, and a beautiful soul. And we are so privileged to have him well and truly be part of the service space ecosystem now. There's no going back, Rob. And we are blessed to know you and thrilled to hear more about your story today. Bella, I'm going to hand off to you now to begin the conversation with Rob.
Thank you, Pavi, for such a beautiful introduction of Rob. Well, we just wanted to begin by creating sort of a context about you, Rob, for us, for everyone on the call. So we were just hoping that maybe you can share some influential stories or experiences from your upbringing or your adolescence years even. I know that's kind of an open-ended question, so.
You know, one of the things that I really appreciated about Rob, well, outside of his Krishna Das music, but was the fact that I think at some point we were talking to him, and he just has this way of quietly mentioning these facts, like, oh yeah, by the way, I chant Om Mani Padme Hum like 3 hours a day. We're like, what do you mean, a day, like once a day? I mean, like one day or every day? He's like, oh, no, every day. You know, it's really my practice. We're like, wow. And I think the first time we met him, there was a book of bodhisattvas on his desk, which was kind of interesting because bodhisattvas are people in Buddhist tradition that dedicate their lives to service, not just lives, but their minds too. And that's a pretty tall order, and so it's beautiful to run across somebody who has that kind of commitment.
Good morning. Thank you so much for all your beautiful, kind words. I hope that I'm always able to live up to those beautiful thoughts and your impression of me. So you wanted me to share a little bit about my adolescence or my beginning, my start, I guess, in life. Okay, well, I just happened to have been born into a pretty poverty-ridden situation with a lot of alcoholism, and in a rural setting where there wasn't a whole lot of spirituality going on that I was aware of or that I could see at the time, and it was pretty tough start. But I just happened to have been born into that, and the reason I say that is I know many other people who were born into much better situations who also ended up with a similar result that I had, and that was that I left home young at 14. I remember having a loaf of bread and a jar of peanut butter and a jar of jam, and no plan, and ended up pretty quickly. I had no life skills at the time. Ended up on the street, panhandling and staying in youth hostels, and I discovered alcohol and drugs, and I thought I had a new best friend. Because suddenly this shy individual could talk to girls and could, have confidence, and so I quickly became addicted and dependent on that. By the time I was 15, I was suicidal. I attempted suicide a couple of times, and by the time I was 18, I was in jail for, by the grace of God, I say, because it saved my life. I got arrested for drugs, and in jail, I started reading some self-help stuff, and I started, for the first time, I was exposed to really positive things. And actually, it was a really old school thing called the power of positive thinking. I think it might have been Dale Carnegie, somebody like that. And that really was, I had never heard of such a thing. Positive thinking, what's that? Wow. And so, yeah, it started to shift my awareness, and I started to look for answers. That was kind of my beginning. And I guess I'm full of grace that I survived it, because many others that were in similar, with similar paths have died, very young, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19 years old. And I've somehow survived. So it brings up the question is, if I'm alive and well, and I've done really well in the other aspects of my life, what's the purpose behind that, and how can I make that meaningful and bring it to its highest good? And it's certainly not to be selfish. It's, to go the opposite direction. And so that's kind of what I'm doing now in my life, working on a daily basis, trying to give and trying to lose the self-centeredness, that many of us struggle with in our society. So,
Thank you, Rob.
thank you.
I remember you sharing when we were in Phoenix about, I think back, in our lives, we all have this experience of our own inner flame kind of being blown out and then having someone come by to relight, rekindle it. And I remember you shared about a particular nurse that you'd met, and I thought maybe it would be nice to have you share a little bit
Right,
about her.
right, right. So basically, when I was a couple of days before my 28th birthday, I was graced with inner surrender. And what I mean by that is, my whole method of trying to survive, which was mainly to stay completely numbed out with alcohol and drugs, no longer worked, hadn't worked in a long time. And just suddenly I had that moment of clarity where, and moment of surrender, where I was willing to do just about anything but what I had been doing. And I ended up in a detox. And when I got into the detox, the nurse that was there, they put you in an observation room when you're new in a detox center, and just to make sure you don't go into serious withdrawal symptoms or whatever. And I decided I was going to leave because she wouldn't give me my medication. And the nurse didn't try to talk me out of it. She asked me where I was going. I said I was leaving. And it was a manipulation, basically. It was like, give me what I want or I'm leaving. But she didn't go for it because she was wise and experienced. And it gave me another moment of clarity where I was able to ask myself, where are you going? You know, she left the room and said, it's too bad, but you're goodbye, you know. And at that moment, I was able to really answer the question that it would be nowhere, you know, but more hell like I'd been in. And I surrendered again. And that was like a turning point because that was like the final surrender to start a new life. And it was thanks to her wisdom and clear seeing of, you know, the manipulation of the addict, you know, and not falling for it. And then the grace was having that moment of clarity where it could have gone either way. And there's no question in my mind that I would be dead if I had left that room. Absolutely no question. So, yeah. So the practice today now is a continuous daily inner surrender followed by action, followed by surrender to the results. That's kind of what's ended up happening from those initial semi-conscious surrenders that happened were mainly driven by pain, now are driven more by a desire to help others and a desire to be free of old habitual patterns of shutting down or not being present. So that's a big part of my practice today.
Can you also share more about how you came into spirituality? Because when you're describing a little bit about your story to us at the retreat, you know, it's just been a huge influence on your life and path and the things that you want to devote your life to. So maybe if you could share about how you came into spirituality and elaborate on what you just described about the practices and how they keep you anchored.
Right. Well, because my particular challenge was with substance abuse, I ended up in some 12-step recovery. And that was the beginning. And that gave me the basic life skill tools to learn how to live without using drugs and alcohol. You know, life skill 101, you know, because I didn't really know how to live. And in those programs, there are spiritual programs. And the first step talks about, you know, the addiction and unmanageability of your life. And the second part of it is coming to believe in something greater than yourself and realizing that you were literally insane the way you were, you know, the person was living, the way I was living. And then the third part of that is making a decision to turn your life and your will over into the care of a God of your own individual understanding. So that was the beginning for me. And then there are other steps later on. And then a big part of that way of life is that having had a spiritual awakening as a result of, you know, applying those principles, you try to carry the message to others. You try to help others. So service is like a key component, and it's mainly focused on other people who are addicted or, you know, are struggling with addiction, who want to change, who want to get free of it, you know. So there's the opportunity for service is quite focused on that. But later on, I became interested in service with every breath or just service, you know, with every step. And that there is so just giving a smile to a stranger, you know, is like such a gift, you know, and so on. So, but the beginning was that, and then I started studying Buddhism, and that really shifted things greatly for me because the teachings are so old, and there's so much wisdom in them that they were just powerful. And Power of Now, Great Earth, or A New Earth, rather, was a life-changing book for me as well, learning how to be present, you know, in the moment.
And what was it, Rob, that got you to, you know, in that moment? I remember sharing a little bit around this where you were talking about that moment of sort of the dark night of the soul. And what was it that got you to turn it around? I mean, was it a prayer? Was it just having had enough? Was it kind of discontentment, or was it just seeing the light? I mean, it's a very it's an unusual thing for people to just turn it around like that, and it seemed like one of those moments happened to you. So can you speak a little bit about how you were able to just internally detach from the suffering?
Thank you. Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's one that I've very, very often over 25 years wondered about as well. And it's all of the things that you mentioned, but I suspect that there's a lot of grace in it, because a lot of it's not about intelligence. There was a lot of pain, and pain was a great suffering. Is a phenomenal motivator. One of the unavoidable truths of our existence is suffering, right? Doesn't matter what situation we're born into, there's going to be a certain amount of suffering, and I had a lot of it, and I just, was fortunate more than anything to get to a point where I had enough willingness and enough desire to step out of that suffering that I was willing to try just about anything, and I think that's a gift that was given to me. And I also, from many people over the years that I've talked to that have had similar experiences, where there's always, I think each one of us has that moment of clarity with whatever we're struggling with, where we can go left or right, or or keep doing the habitual thing that we've always done that doesn't work, And so stepping out of the habitual patterns is a choice. And it means facing a lot of uncomfortable feelings and, a lot of pain that we've been running from. But it's actually the thing that leads us towards happiness. So, I don't know. I think it's a gift. I think it was a gift, and it continues to be a gift and a choice. I hope that helps answer that question.
That's beautiful.
It really struck me when you said, suffering is a phenomenal motivator, and that, in many ways, others have said suffering is grace, and it can be seen as a gift, and it's our choice how we learn from it. But it's hard to realize that, and it would be wonderful if you could share or give advice from your own deep reflections for individuals that are suffering and feeling broken and lost, and just from your own experiences and learnings, like what sort of advice would you share with people?
Well, that's a tough one. You guys ask tough questions. Well, I guess it's a process in a way, and the language of recovery is that we hit a bottom. So basically, or we hit a point of surrender, if we're lucky. Many people don't ever hit that point, but if we do sense that, if we have this inner self-honesty and we look at what we're doing, whatever the behavior is that's shutting us down or that keeps us in more suffering, we're all looking for happiness, but some of the things that we do lead the opposite. We're looking for pleasure, but it's followed by pain. So if we have the addiction, for me, what it really is the habit of reaching for something outside of myself, or in the case of fantasy, inside of myself, to distract me from being alive, from feeling my pain or my fear from the past or whatever it is. And it's just that core habit of always reaching for distraction. And if I could say anything to help anyone, it's just, if it's not working and it hasn't worked for a long time, then just reach out to people and let them know you're hurting. That's the beginning, admission, self-admission, right? And I still do that today. I mean, I haven't sort of arrived at some nirvana place where I don't have any challenges with my own being and my own awareness and, my own emotions. I still have a great support around me of probably 10 individuals that I talk to pretty much every week, and we all share our challenges, you know, that, you know, and our new awareness and our, you know, what's working and what's not working. So the habit goes very deep in our society of shutting down, trying to numb out, trying to take the edge off. And it's like a lifelong practice to open up and not do that, you know, and to fuel it with, you know, loving kindness and compassion, you know, as a foundation for that kind of work, because it requires bravery to stay with uncomfortable feeling, with uncomfortable emotion. You know, it takes work. So there's no quick solution, I'm sorry to say. But surrender is the key.
Oh, that's a disappointing response. I was hoping for the miracle pill. Or
I know. I know. I wish there was. I'd take it too.
You know, one of the things that I think when you were talking about that kind of stemming or checking our impulse to reach out for distraction and to really sit with that pain and that being and sitting with that ability to make the choice that leads to happiness, I think a key part of that I've seen in you is that, you know, you kind of hold your life in an open palm. There's not that that tight fist, you know, in so many different ways. And I remember you talking about a time when you actually went through something that had you really saying goodbye to, you know, and letting go of things in your life. Could you talk a little bit about that and the insights that it led to?
Saying goodbye and letting go of something. Did I mention something specific?
You had mentioned a time, actually, when I guess you had a diagnosis from your doctor.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was such a gift. I had a bunch of physical symptoms that pointed towards cancer, and in our medical system in Canada, it takes a while to get to see specialists and get tests, and it's social medicine, but there are long waits for specialized service. So by the time I got to see long before I got to see the specialist, I was convinced that I was dying because I'd done my research and I was in a lot of pain, and I thought I was maybe had a year or two at the most to live, and it wasn't going to be a whole lot of fun. So I got to go through the whole process pretty much of dying, or most of it. And, you know, I realized that I was okay with going. And the only attachment that I was resisting was I had a 14-year-old son. And his mother, he was alive and with him and everything, but she wasn't very healthy. And I just wanted to be there for my son. And but it was such a great experience to have that really convinced that I was probably going to be dead pretty soon. And was it okay? And, you know, what did that mean? And, you know, so there are actually exercises out there where you can do that, you know, where you experience, but this one just was sort of dropped in my lap. So ever since then, I've had an even more of an appreciation for life and for the fragility of it and, you know, the temporary nature of it and so on. So, yeah, that's what I was mentioning.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned your son here and there, but I don't know if any of us know a lot about him, but it seems that he inspires you quite a bit, as does your artwork, which I'm not sure if everyone on the call knows. You're such a talented artist. And so I just wanted to also, you know, if you can share more about just what all of your inspirations, what inspires you about life, what makes you smile, and what do you wish more people would realize in their own lives? Because I think at one point you even said that sometimes you feel like this part of your life is a bonus, when you realize that you thought you were going to die and you were saying goodbye to everyone and everything that you love. So those two questions are...
Mm. more tough questions. my son's very dear to me. He did add great and has added a lot of meaning to my life and opened me up to love. You know, because of my upbringing and because of, you know, my life experience prior to him being born, you know, I still had a lot of walls up and my heart was still, you know, pretty protected. And I think everyone who's had a child may have experienced this kind of thing. And for me, what it did was it created a sense of love and vulnerability that I had never allowed myself to feel. And so, yeah, I love him very deeply. And I also feel a huge spiritual responsibility to be there for him. His mom is really unhealthy. She struggles with mental illness, and it's untreated. And so he's had a lot of suffering, a lot of emotional suffering in his life. And that was like another heartbreaking kind of thing for me. And but you know, he's here today with me at the Hacienda in Phoenix, and he's been here, and he plays violin. He started violin when he was four, but he wanted to have a violin and wanted to learn about it, and a deeply talented musician. And you know, he's an incredible guy, and he's a great teacher for me. Patience, tolerance, love, acceptance, all of it, you know. It makes me really look into myself before I speak, and you know, he's just a great teacher. So, yeah. And the art. When I left home at about 14 years old, prior to that, the one thing that was working for me was I had started painting when I was around 12 or 13, and I had a desire to study art. I never have, but I've started painting about 5 or 6 years ago, and it's a fairly private passion that I, you know, and my hope is that I'll have more time to continue painting. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say about that, really.
You know, Rob, one of the things that, this is Amit, by the way, one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, how did you make that transition? I mean, you know, from being on the streets, essentially, to alcohol and drugs, then to making this pivot. I know you had talked about being in jail and reading the book, but then, you know, was there something sort of more of a catalyst that helped turn things around? And then if you could maybe tell us a little bit about how you turned into a very sort of successful entrepreneur.
The main principle was that instead of walking around powerless, you know, with this deep sense of powerlessness and unmanageability, I was taught to take my will in my life and to turn it over, to discover a God of my own understanding, whatever faith or, you know, I'm not religious, but I developed a faith in a power, loving, forgiving power greater than myself, and explored that search for that, and then I made a decision to turn my whole being over to the care, the loving care of that God as I understood him. When I started applying that principle in my life, miracles happen every day. And, you know, when I opened my first little shop, retail store, I had one employee. I was 2 years, I'd been free of alcohol and drugs for 2 years. I still really didn't know how to live, and I was new at applying that principle with turning things over and getting divine grace into it, inviting it in, you know, to be the manager of my life. And I phoned up my spiritual mentor at the time, and his name was Frank Garcia, and I said, Frank, I had a lot of fear. I've opened this store. I don't know how to run a store. I don't know how to run my own life still. I don't know how to be a boss, an employer. How am I supposed to do that? And he said, yeah, Robert, you better not. You're right. You better not run it. And I said, what do you mean? Who's going to run it? He said, well, do you trust the God of your understanding to help you stay sober and, you know, and learn how to live? And I said, yes, I do. He said, well, why don't you have him run your company? And why don't you be the assistant manager? And I said, wow, what a great concept. I said, yeah, okay. So he said, let's ask him right now. And then he told me, he said, Robert, here's what's going to happen. You're going to be very successful because you now have the best manager you could possibly have, divine, you know, divinity. And he said, people are going to ask you, how did you do it? And you're going to need to tell them, you didn't do it. you had help, and this is the kind of help you had. So that principle of becoming divinely powered rather than self-will, you know, self-centered self-will, right? So how I would know when I was running, not allowing God to run the show, is I would start to get stressed out and fearful. Well, that's where self-will leads me. So I just have applied that principle over the years, and the same thing with this property, and I turn my employees over to the care of God as I understand them. I don't try to run things. And so I'm a big believer in synchronicity and divine chance, and that's why when Patty called me, I knew there was no mistake. Absolutely no mistake. My prayer for this property, when I received it as a gift from the universe, was that it be used for things like that, for retreats and for, you know, spiritual, any kind of a spiritual event, right? And so that was probably was the answer to my prayer, you know. And so are all of you. So I've been deeply touched by Service Space and all of the people that I met at that retreat, and I think about you all daily, you know. So I mean, thank you so much, you know.
Can you speak a little bit about your entrepreneurship, Rob? Because you've really, you know, what are some of the things that you have been doing? Because I remember some of the ideas around hunger, and one-to-one, kind of this model of Tom's Shoes that you want to bring to food, and serendipities around it. It'd be great if you spoke a little bit about how you segued your entrepreneurial journey.
A couple of years ago, I had the idea about food, you know, hunger being one of the big issues in the world, and affordable food. And I was inspired by Tom's Shoes as a model, where they basically give away a pair of shoes for every pair they sell. And I thought about food, and I thought, how could we apply that same principle with food? And this was intended not to be a for-profit. This would be a fully non-profit type business. And the principle was that we would partner with large food companies like Whole Foods. We would act, we would behave, and we would run it like a normal business, except that all the profit would go back to buying food or food in kind for others. So the name of the idea was foodforpeople.org. And the principle was that we would provide health, we would offer on the free market, we would go out and compete with entire, you know, for-profit companies, buy food, branded as for people, foodforpeople.org, and for every pound of rice we sold, we'd give away a pound, or whatever, you know, the equivalent that we could afford to do so that we could still be sustainable and self-supporting, but that we would give it all away, give it all back to the community. And I think that the big thing about that would be it would motivate the other food companies, who would force them to start giving. Because, you know, we would be competing side by side on the shelf with them. And my initial reaction from people, including some people at Whole Foods, was they're all for it. I haven't been able to get it off the ground yet, I think that the basic idea, you know, the framework of it is probably, you know, quite good. So that's basically one idea that I would like to pursue. And if I had the right kind of help, I think I could do it. And the entrepreneur skills that came to me from 20 years of doing business, I think can be a great benefit for nonprofit, you know, type enterprise. But yeah, so that's about it. That's the basic idea.
That's great, Rob. You know, this is reminding me of that painting that you shared with us, and the words that you had had that accompanied it said something to the effect of, we all depend on each other in more ways than we know. And I just, you know, was really interested in hearing you talk a little bit about the role of kindness you know, both in whether it's in your spiritual practice or in your work or in your life journey? What role does kindness play?
Well, it's everything, really. You know, if I want to be happy, then I need to give. And if I want to be, if I want to suffer, then I need to take. So loving kindness is like the ultimate gift, right, that I can give myself to begin with. And I guess if it has to start with one's own self. I have to practice, learn how to accept myself for exactly all of my warts and wrinkles and you know, and my good qualities and so on, the whole package, and have a foundation of loving kindness for myself. And then I'm naturally inspired to be that way with others, you know. It's basically just doing the opposite of our cultural self-centered society. You know, I'm no expert in loving kindness. I'm no expert in any of this stuff. I'm still just a, you know, a student of life. I know that giving leads to happiness. That's all I know. That's the main thing that stuck out for me in the Buddhist studies is one of the lamas just basically said, you know, if you want to be happy, think of others. All joy and happiness comes from thinking of other, or giving to other, or, you know, being kind to other. And all suffering comes from thinking of ourselves. So when we're obsessed with our own agenda, our own self, we create suffering for ourselves and others. And when we drop that, or we practice to dropping that, and just think of I hope that one thing I say in this call will help somebody. That's my aspiration. With one thing helps one person, then it was a good call, right? You know?
Rob, yeah. That's actually very spot on. I was going to say that, you know, there was actually an article in the New York Times this past Sunday that actually spoke a little bit to that in terms of individuals thinking of, you know, if you have more money, then it allows you to buy more and more stuff for ourselves. But when you actually look at what the research shows, you're better off served in many cases by simply buying less and just buying for others. And that actually ends up leading to a greater sense of happiness.
Hi, Rob. I want to thank you for sharing all your wisdom. My question for you is, you were just sharing some of your knowledge and life practice, if you could share with all of us the power of choice in a moment where we choose to maybe serve others or we choose to connect with the element of suffering, if you can give them some of your tips on how to navigate that moment.
For me personally, the big thing is that I'm very aware that I have a lot of habitual reactions in my you know, moment-to-moment awareness. Some of them are very old. Many of them don't work. But they still, because they're so familiar and because they're so deeply ingrained, it's almost like a lifelong practice to drop them. So what quite often happens is, for example, this phone call is way out of my comfort zone. Right. I would much rather be, I'm willing to do it, I love it, but it's way out of my comfort zone. So I had to make a choice to step out of my comfort zone. And very often, creating new habits or making the right choice, you know, to do the next right thing, is uncomfortable. You know? If my style is usually to hide out and isolate, and then, you know, I get asked to go on a call with 30 or 40 people. That's a good example of making those kind of choices. So very often the new choice is uncomfortable, but it's also the right choice, you know. So my philosophy is do the next right thing, whether it's brush my teeth or, you know, meditate or go for a walk or eat food, whatever it is, help someone, you know, be of service. Just do the next right thing, and then when that's done, do the next right thing. And that's how I exercise choice, is what's the next right thing. And that's kind of my guidepost for that.
I love what you said, Rob, about, like, do the next right thing. And I was thinking back to a story you shared about actually how the hacienda came to you, and how there were so many. It was hard to see. It was hard to tell who was giving and who was receiving in that interaction, in that particular story. And I wonder if you can share a little bit about that, about the couple and your interaction with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I was looking for some kind of place to go to in the winter from Canada, and you know, the climate's awful. And over a period of 7 months, I looked at many different properties, and I offered to buy a couple of them. And there were always roadblocks coming up. And I sometimes a roadblock is just a good indication that it's not the next right thing, so to speak. And I live in surrender, so, and I live in faith and confidence that, you know, divine is sort of working, and please make it obvious, you know, is what you, sometimes my prayer, please make it obvious to me so I know the next right thing to do. So I would step back from these other, you know, supposedly failed purchases of real estate. And then finally one night in Vancouver, I was inspired to search in a certain way that I hadn't ever searched in online. And I found this property, and it was, you know, five times more than I wanted to spend, for example. It was, you know, it was kind of almost ridiculous, right? and beyond my budget, I didn't have the funds to do it, but I pursued it anyway. I went and I wanted to see it because something just really spoke to me about it, and it just seemed like an amazing, amazing place and unusual. And I, long story short, I ended up sitting in the living room with the owners. I think he was 80, Bob, and Anne was 75. And they were just kind of tired of, they believed that it was a sacred place as well. And they were tired of looking after it, and it was time, you know, for them to downsize. And long story short, I mean, you know, it just happened. It just unfolded every step of the way. I just showed up, and I just kept doing the next step, and it ended up, I feel like I'm the caretaker of it for however long I'm here, and, you know, it's just a total gift, really. They gave me a mortgage so that I could buy it, I'm part of it. If they hadn't been willing to do that, I couldn't have bought it. I was able to sell some property that I owned, which I hadn't really planned on doing. That all worked out, and just everything, you know, was good synchronicity and meant to be. And so there it is.
And I remember you talking about that moment when it was time for them to hand over the keys, and you...
Right. Yeah, so we became kind of, we started a relationship, really. I mean, you know, we had many interactions over the next 5-6 months before I bought it. And the last moment that I saw them, the day that they were handing over the master keys to the whole property, and I already had a set by then, something just told me, the look, the expression that was in Anne's eyes of, you know, sadness, really. And I just said, Anne, why don't you keep those keys and, you know, just, you know where everything is, come by and stay here anytime, you know. And, you know, we all had a little tear, and she was, I think, fairly humbled by that gesture. And, you know, that was just one of those things that wasn't planned, you know, but she still has keys. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, Rob, this is Amit again. You know, when you sit and you talk about your past and the challenges with which you do, it seems some almost matter-of-factly. And, you know, when I think about some of my, let's say, my own challenges, even my own skeletons in the closet, there's this fear that there's hesitation to even talk or share about it, you know, and they leave scars on you, and, you know, you almost can't let go of them. And even though they happened in the past, they're still affecting you today. But it seems that, you know, you've been able to sort of move away from that. And so I'm just curious how you've been able to do that, or how you look at your past.
Right. Two ways. Probably the easiest way, and the most current practice, is that I've learned how to lean into my vulnerability. It's another Buddhist thing, Pema Chodron. talks about, you know, how our usual reaction is to avoid vulnerability or avoid going to the places that are painful, avoid our broken heart, avoid our sadness, right? This is just, we armor up and we just, you know, try to survive it and maybe learn from it. But we don't really want to go there because it's painful. And there's a practice in Buddhism that's the opposite of that. And you basically lean into that. And part of the reason, by just staying with it, learning how to stay with, you know, the energy, right? The emotion that, and don't forget, there's a storyline that we have made up about all these events. And that's all they are, stories. They don't actually have any real existence. And so I lean into the energy of it. I stay, and I find out that there's gold in that there. You know, that's where the real treasure is, because that's what will connect me with someone else who also has a broken heart, you know, who also has gone through a lot, and, you know, and so on. And so it's like doing the opposite, really. It's very scary. But with training, right, you know, and practice, and sitting meditation is something that helps me with that, because quite often if I'm sitting, all this crazy stuff comes up, right? You know, and the mind is still very busy. and some of it's like, you know, 30 years old, 40 years old. Suddenly I'm in my childhood. So the practice for me is just to, you know, to be curious about it, have some, you know, loving kindness about it and patience, and just kind of look at it and, you know, what is that, you know, and stay with it. So I'm learning to stay has been a really great teaching for me. It just means staying with all the uncomfortable stuff and all the great stuff as well.
That's great.
That makes, yeah, hope that helps.
Absolutely.
I actually had another question, Rob. This is Bella.
Hi, Bella.
Hi. you know, going, well, it's tied to your practices, but also, you know, running sort of a business. I can't imagine the kind of influence you might have had on your employees or continue to have on your employees. Do you have any stories to share about if you run your business differently than other models? And are there people that you work with that inspire you? Or, I mean, what kind of dynamic exists, I guess, in your workplace that might be different from the typical model?
Okay, thank you. The way I run my company now is very, very different than I ran it in the beginning. It's still divinely powered. But up until about a year ago, I always had a certain formula for running. It was retail stores mostly. And I would have a manager for each store and an assistant manager. And, you know, everyone had their titles. And now I run it in a very unorthodox way. There's no manager. Everyone is equal in the company. They have all let, I've asked each one of them, what would you like to do in the company? What area do you want to be responsible for? You know, and then we help each other. So we have accountability. We take on ownership. And each one of us knows what we're supposed to do, and then we all help each other as well, right? So there's no big bad wolf in the company. And I stay out of it as much as I can, partly because I want to paint, but partly because I want it, it's working. It's a phenomenally different way of doing things. And in retail, traditionally, managers stay for about 2 years, and then they move on, or less. And so you're caught, and then a new manager comes in. Everyone gets shooken up because they have a whole different way of doing things, and half the people leave. And now I have nobody leaving now. Nobody leaves the company. They love it. They're happy. They're proud. They have a strong sense of ownership and accountability, and they've volunteered their accountability. You know what I mean? No one's asked them to do anything outside of their own awareness or willingness to be part of that. So it's something very new for me, but and the store is doing incredibly well, much better than it's ever done. And there's respect. Yeah, so that's how we do that.
Can I work for you, Rob?
Pardon me?
Can I work for you?
yeah, right. Sure.
We're all moving.
Tell me what you want to do.
And then also was hoping that Rob could share maybe a story or so for that, you know, of other folks that have been touched by the retreat space that he has out in Phoenix.
Well, I've had this property about 10 months now, and we've only actually been offering it for rent for about 6 or 7 months. So the biggest impact has been service space. The week prior to that, teachersforamerica.org was there, but we didn't have the same kind of connection. I think it's just beginning to be, it's a very under the radar kind of property, and it's mostly unknown. We did another group, oh my God, I can't even remember the name, it was a local female volunteer group. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name. Yeah, so far, you guys have been the stars.
We'll take it.
I just want to have more people, you know, more organizations like that here, you know. And, you know, I'm totally willing to make it work, you know, for that to happen. I'm open to suggestions. I haven't really tried to go out there and find people. You know, they just are finding this place on their own, other than that one ad that's on the internet. And I don't know. In fact, right now the property is almost completely empty, and you know, you're all welcome. Get in your car and come down.
That's great. Thank you. You know, I'm gonna actually we have another question, Rob, from
okay.
Bill, and so.
Okay.
Oh, hey, Rob. It's Bill. Yeah,
hi, Bill.
It seems like forming a relationship with a higher power was pretty pivotal in turning your life around and how you conduct your life now. And I'm just curious how did you find that higher power? Did it come from a childhood thing, or did you, just how did you form that connection?
Yeah, no, it didn't come at all from childhood. It started with just the basic, someone actually gave me the basic idea for what maybe a higher power might or could look like, and they said, there's no real set criteria, just except for the following, that it should be something loving, it should be greater than you, it should be loving, understanding, forgiving. Those are the kind of principles, you know, the framework. You don't want a punishing concept, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it started, and then I just started reading, you know, different books and you know, searching. And I started praying, and someone told me, you know, it doesn't really matter if you understand it, or because if it's greater than you, it obviously would understand you. And if it's not there, you haven't really lost anything. But if there is something there, why not ask it for help and guidance? And so I started very, very simply, and just in the morning I would ask for help to live that day and to not, you know, go back into my old habits of using or, you know, getting loaded. And, you know, to guide me in my life. And then at night I would say thank you. And that's where it started. And, you know, I don't even know what it is now. It's just so part of my life that it just feels pretty natural. But, any beginning is a good beginning. But definitely a life lived on that basis has been a huge difference for me. You know, again, getting rid of self-will and, you know, has been key.
I actually have a question. This is Audrey. If I can just jump in.
Yes, please.
Hi, Audrey.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, I love the, I've been talking about how you live in surrender and how the God of understanding drives your business. And I was wondering if you have any moments where that has manifested in your work or in your life, like any specific stories.
Where that's manifested in my life, where it's been really obvious? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, many, 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 too many for 4 minutes. Yeah. So many split-second coincidences. One last story. After a year in business, I had one supplier. I was doing vintage clothing. That's all I did. and it was recycled, you know, clothing, textiles. And I had one supplier. I hadn't been able to find another good supplier, and I had saved $4,000 in my first year in business, and I was going to go to Asia and buy, try and diversify a little bit, buy some jewelry and go to Bali and so on. And the day before I was supposed to leave, I got a phone call from my one supplier telling me he couldn't sell to me anymore. And I won't go into detail, but there was just no way he could. It wasn't anything I had done, but he just couldn't do it. He had some other guy. And so I didn't know whether to go to Thailand or not, and because I'd never been there, didn't know where I was going. So I did my third step prayer. I said, okay, God, you know, I'm afraid. I don't know what to do. Please guide me. And I went out of my car. Something told me to stop the car. I walked into this shop. I was in a different city, by the way. I wasn't in my hometown. And I walked into the shop, and everything in the store was from Thailand and Bali. I walked up to the owner of the store, and I told him what I just told you guys. I said, you know, I don't know what to do. I'm supposed to go tomorrow. This is all the money I have in the world. I've never been there. This guy spent 2 or 3 hours with me telling me the names and addresses of suppliers, what their personalities were like. Well, watch out for this guy, but he's good. And, you know, and he stopped himself about halfway through it. He said, I don't know why I'm telling you all this. Do you know how many years it took me to find all these suppliers? And, you know, and I looked at him and I said, I know why you're telling me. You're the answer to my prayer, to my morning prayer. And you don't need to be afraid about sharing this with me, because I'm never going to take it and use it to my advantage, you know, and compete with you or anything like that. And, you know, you're literally the, and he went, okay. And he just kept going. And so I knew that it was the right thing to go. So I've had so many things like that happen. It's just amazing. And it doesn't actually even surprise me anymore. I just go, okay, thanks God. Yeah, I know you're there, you know. So, yeah, that's one good example, I think. And that totally changed the business. Suddenly it was better than, far better than it had ever been. And, you know, we went from 4 employees to 50 employees in the next 2 years. And, yeah, it was crazy. So.
I think Pavi was going to take over.
All right. This is it. Rob, I was just, you know, thinking about how there's a pretty powerful and profound metaphor here. I don't know if you mentioned it, but Rob's company is called True Value Vintage, and it's a company that turns around vintage clothing and gives it... What was that? It's a company that turns around vintage clothing and gives it a new lease on life. And that's really kind of the same thing he did with the hacienda that he purchased from the elderly couple. You know, he gave this old sacred property a chance to live on. And really it's the same thing that he did with his own life when he chose in that clinic so many decades ago to surrender and place his life in the hands of his God of understanding. When he chose to lean into his vulnerability and transform his pain into a path to happiness, he's left us with so many nuggets of wisdom and insight today. You know, I know I'm going to try and remember to focus on doing the next right thing and to just come back to that simple, you know, nugget that giving leads to happiness. And I think all of us are going to go out after this call and hire a new boss, you know. That's divinity. So thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Gavi, and thanks, everyone, for allowing me the opportunity to share on this call. It's wonderful. Thank you.